Okay. David Loin, who is never late for anything, he informs me, is now here, as is Christina Lamb, who also is never late for anything. I'm late all the time, but somehow managed to get here. Welcome. And for those of you who are just coming into the room, please have some of our food and drink and relax and get settled in for conversation. Welcome to an evening we're grandly titling Reporting in Afghanistan, Reporting America's War. We didn't quite plan it this way, but today is, in fact, the 8th anniversary of the opening of the American war in Afghanistan. This afternoon, President Obama has been huddled, meeting with his advisors and generals and national security staff, trying to make decisions that the New York Times today calls clearly agonizing. We, however, are not agonized. We are better off than President Obama because we have Christina Lamb and David Loin, who between them have far more years of experience on the ground than probably all of the combined advisors and generals and national security staff in the White House. Couple of housekeeping notes. Well, first of all, let me welcome you. I'm Bruce Shapiro, Executive Director of the DART Center for Journalism and Trauma, a resource center here at the Journalism School for journalists who cover violence, conflict, and trauma, which describes the situation in Afghanistan pretty well, I suppose. We provide a wide range of programs for journalists, educators, researchers, www.dartcenter.org. Housekeeping. First of all, on the table in back, there are a number of DART Center booklets, guides, and other propaganda, which are free. I urge you to take some, take many, take them all. The table in the back, as I mentioned earlier, is a woman who is very kindly selling David's and Christina's books, and I'm sure that David and Christina will sign them afterwards, making them even more priceless than they are already. Please buy their books. This session is audio recorded and will eventually be podcast streamed or in some other electronic form be available. So consider that a consumer warning. When it comes time for the Q&A, your words will be preserved for posterity on the record. Three events I want to make sure to tell you about. Next Tuesday afternoon, the Cabot Prize for Journalism in the Americas, along with the DART Center, is presenting a panel called Across the Hall in the Lecture Hall, 5 p.m., Arriving at the Truth, Journalism in the Americas. That will be Tuesday evening, will be a very exciting and provocative panel, I think. Next week on the 15th, which is, I guess, Thursday, from 12:30 to 2, there's a brown bag lunch discussion co-sponsored with the, that the DART Center is co-sponsoring with the School of International Public Affairs, with Iason Athanides, who's the Christian Science Monitor correspondent, who spent 3 weeks in prison in Iran earlier this year, has been covering Iran for many years. That will be at the International Affairs Building over on 118th Street. And then finally, for those of you who are, if any of you are, journalism school students here, tomorrow night I will be giving a lecture called Covering Violence, What Journalists Need to Know. It's an all-class lecture. It will be in the lecture hall at what time, somebody? I think 6:30. Okay. Oh, and quick thanks here before I go any further. Thanks to everybody who put this event together, David and Christina, first of all, but also Kate Black and Kelly Boyce and others from the DART Center staff, Arlene Morgan, Associate Dean of the Journalism School, who is here, and, of course, the Journalism and Maintenance Journalism School maintenance staff and technical staff who've arranged for this beautiful room to be available on an important evening. Well, so the U.S. has had 8 years to try to make sense of Afghanistan, and if the leaks and counter-leaks and arguments and agonized debates within the Democratic Party, within Congress, within the military are any indication, those 8 years have left more confusion than clarity. David Loyne and Christina Lamb, between them, have had far more than 8 years' experience with Afghanistan and South Asia. They've had decades. They have reported on occupying empires, more than one, more than two, on rebellious mujahideen, on marginalized communities, on women, on all sorts of deep community issues that together make up the fabric of a very complex part of the world in which American policymakers and American media are now trying to make sense of. Briefly to introduce the two of them. David Loyne, as a journalist, David had something happen to him last year that leaves me and anyone else who's here in the room kind of envious. He was denounced in Parliament. The cause of his denunciation... There were people who wanted him tried for treason, and the cause of this was David's serious attempt to interview and profile leaders of the Taliban and present their side of a conflict embroiling not only the U.S. and Afghanistan, but, of course, Britain. David is the BBC Developing World Correspondent. His latest book, which was the excuse for this evening, is In Afghanistan, 200 Years of British, Russian, and American Occupation, with a simply haunting cover that you should take a look at later. You should certainly buy it. For the past three decades, he's reported for the BBC from Afghanistan, Kashmir, Moscow, Iraq. As the developing world correspondent, he combines what you might describe as traditional war reporting with a fine-tuned sociologist's power to investigate some of the most troubled spots on the planet. He also wrote a great book, which for journalism historians in this room is especially important, Frontline, The True Story of the British Mavericks Who Changed the Face of War Reporting. A fascinating story of journalism in a period of great turmoil in the early 1990s, which has real meaning today. He was, like Christina Lamb, a participant in a special program at the Dart Center, Dart Center Ockberg Fellows Program. Christina Lamb is, as of just a few weeks ago, the Washington, D.C. correspondent for the Sunday Times of London. She has been a correspondent, too, for multiple decades. Her reporting from Pakistan, Afghanistan, Brazil, South Africa has been acclaimed. She was the first Western correspondent to report on the Taliban, riding on the back of motorcycles with young Taliban when nobody else was paying any attention to them. She's written a whole bunch of books. I won't give you all the titles that are in your program, but her most recent book is Small Wars Permitting, and back there they have The Sewing Circles of Herat, a memoir of Afghanistan. Too many awards to mention, but I will say that she's been named by She Magazine one of Britain's most inspirational women, which I believe to be true, and by the Asha Foundation as one of their inspirational women worldwide. She, too, was a Dart Center Ockberg Fellow. What drew them to the Dart Center and engages us at the Dart Center, who are very interested in how reporting on violence of all sorts can be done better, is a kind of war reporting that goes beyond the bang-bang, that goes beyond the daily violence of bombs and bodies, to encompass as well the structural violence that creates fertile soil for war, the historic violence, the historical injuries and present-day fears that get wars going or keep them going. They're also both distinguished by a kind of thoughtful insistence on stepping back from the present and asking how, why, where are we going? Just consider this little paragraph from David's book describing the state of Afghanistan not too long before the American invasion. The violent stalemate in Kabul. This is after the fall of the Soviet Union. The violent stalemate in Kabul also meant that there was now no check on disorder and criminality across the rest of the country. Reconstruction was at a standstill. For mile after mile, mud-walled villages had been reduced to what looked like termite mounds. The main roads were bombed into dust tracks, making it quicker to cycle than to drive from city to city. And every few miles, travelers would be confronted by a chain marking the control of another petty warlord who would claim a toll to provide protection. Kandahar, the capital of the Pashtun heartland, slid into decadence, culminating in a tank battle on the streets between two commanders who both wanted sex with the same boy. That's the landscape that these correspondents know, and which policymakers in Washington are only, it seems, just beginning after 8 years to wrestle with in a serious way. Here's how we're going to proceed. David Loin will come up to the microphone and talk a bit about his book, where it leads him to think about our present-day predicament. We'll then move into a conversation between David and Christina, and then eventually move to questions. Look forward to a conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. Well, eight years into the war, a new young president looking at a number of policy options, one of the key ones being to Afghanize the country, real concern over the Afghan leader who's in place and desire to replace him with another one, and the key policy priority option on the table being more troops. It does exactly precisely describe, of course, what's happening today in the United States, but actually that's what happened in Moscow in 1987. I mean, all of those options 8 years into the Russian war were being considered in exactly the way that the United States is now considering its options in a country which has this reputation as being the graveyard of empires, the place that no one could conquer. And as a reporter, I mean, Christina goes back 30 years in Afghanistan. I go back a mere 15, 16 years. She started there when she was 10 years old. As a child reporter. You know, remember Tintin. As a reporter, I was, and having been into this country a lot, and you look at the history of my own country, and certainly Britain never stayed as long as 8 years. They tried twice in the 19th century. The longest they managed on both occasions, they would have settled Afghanistan and brought it into the British Empire. That's what they did in those days. But they failed. On both occasions, the war aims changed. That's always happened of any invader that's gone into Afghanistan. The war aims have significantly altered, and in both occasions, they left in power a ruler who was significantly made far stronger by the fact that he had been the person who'd emerged out of the ashes of another British attempt. Both Dost Mohammad and Abdurrahman, the two most significant rulers of Afghanistan in the 19th century, emerged stronger from a British attempt to take the country. And the third war in 1919 was distinguished by the first serious bombing of civilians by the Royal Air Force, something which, of course, became far more prominent later in the 20th century. But as a reporter, looking back over this history, the graveyard of empires is too simple a view. What was it about Afghanistan that made it so difficult to hold for these countries that had taken it so easily? And I just like to look at two F's, if you like. One, the frontier, and the other, fundamentalism. And the first F, the frontier, we forget as we fly over this territory so easily in jets nowadays quite what it's like on the ground underneath. Afghanistan is a country of deserts and mountains. Only 5% of the land is irrigable agricultural land. There is this huge mountain range to the east of Afghanistan, became the northwest frontier of Pakistan, divided by the British in an unstable border. The most unstable border in the world goes down the middle of that mountain range, divided in 1893. The extraordinary tale of the negotiations between this big king and a rather pompous British civil servant is one of the chapters in my book. Having read the diaries of both of them, I could see how they each was trying to pull the wool over the other one's eyes. But in the end, the British drew this border down a mountain range which is 400 miles long and 200 miles wide and has just three useful passes crossing it. And the mountains go up to 15,000, 16,000 feet. And, of course, it's natural guerrilla territory. One of those passes, the most famous, of course, being the Khyber Pass. The southernmost pass, the Bolan Pass, ended up, in fact, being on the British side of the frontier. And the frontier was drawn across the mountains in the south. and the middle one, the one the American forces like to call the parrot's beak, but the British in the 19th century called the camel's neck. But you get the idea. It's a shape of mountains like that, and that's quite near to Tora Bora, the cave complex where Osama bin Laden set up all those years ago. So there are just three ways of crossing this mountains, and we forget that as we, with a $500 billion defense budget, try and hold onto this country. This is a place which has created the toughest race of people in the world, with their own very, very solid honor code and powerful tribal values, which keeps them together, makes them hospitable to guests if they're invited, as I was when the Taliban invited me, but hostile to strangers. And that honor code, in fact, saved my life when I was with the Taliban. Bruce mentioned the treason charge that was proposed in the House of Commons. I spent a few days with Taliban commanders, and a group of other Taliban who weren't in on the invitation came to kill me. And I saw this Pashtun honor code working, fortunately, in my favor, as the commander who'd invited me said, if you want to kill him, you'll have to kill me first. And the guys were, he won the argument. This is a place, and those mountains, which when you go right back through the records to the 18th century and through the 19th century, always created a significant opposition to any foreigner who came in. And the thing that they used from those mountains and Afghanistan beyond was the second F, which was fundamentalism. One of the really key things which the United States forgot in the 1980s when shoveling first millions, then hundreds of millions, and then in the end billions into the pockets of fundamentalist leaders, Mujahideen leaders in the war against Russia, was that these were people who did not share the values that the United States had, and ultimately fought among themselves when they took the country. And that's one of the really key strands in my research, and one of the things that I draw out in this book, is that this was not new. This didn't sort of pop up in the 1980s. The first use of the word Talib or Taliban as a fighter against the British that I could discover was 1880. And in 1897, in the frontier war, a war reported by a precocious young war correspondent called Winston Churchill, later, of course, became Britain's wartime prime minister. And the young Churchill, in a really good book, I mean, a frighteningly good book for a 22-year-old, called The Frontier War, identifies among the enemy in the worst of the conflicts that the British faced in the frontier during their period, a group of men called the Taliban, who were tougher fighters than the others, were far more willing to be martyrs, and were people who lived, he says, at the expense of the people. And they were theological students. They were just the same kind of people as the Taliban who emerged in the mid-1990s. Now, the Taliban who emerged in the mid-1990s weren't some kind of unique aberration then in Afghanistan. They were a development from this very strong move and mood within the country that Islamic fundamentalism could always be drawn on, a particular kind of Islamism could be drawn on in order to combat the invader. And during the 1980s, Sharia law emerged in Afghanistan well before the time that the Taliban came in. Girls had to go to school in burqas in the early 1980s because the Mujahideen saw that as being a way of defining the nation that they wanted. It became a political pursuit. It became Islamicization of Afghanistan was one of the very few things that gave it social focus at a time when everything else had been destroyed by the Russian invasion and by the consequent social dislocation in the country. And when those Mujahideen leaders then fought among themselves in the early 1990s, that's when the Taliban emerged, and Bruce described, read this paragraph from my book, particularly in the south, of how difficult it was for ordinary life to continue in a place where there were roadblocks every few miles and complete disorder led by these people who had been funded by the United States and Saudi Arabia to defeat the Russians and then fought among themselves for the spoils, ending up with the Taliban's emergence in the mid-1990s. Now, I just, in the, I don't know how many minutes I have left, but I hesitate to offer policy prescriptions for Afghanistan, particularly in Columbia Journalism School, with a rather thoughtful essay in Columbia Journalism Review this month suggesting that Western correspondents are far too aligned with counterinsurgency strategy and are arguers for the idea that there is a workable counterinsurgency strategy in the country. But anyway, let me try. I mean, I plead if the charge is understanding the country better and taking a more intelligent policy towards Afghanistan, then I certainly think the international community should do that. One of the key big failings since 2001, and this war is still absolutely winnable, but one of the key failings since 2001 has been in aid policy. Most American aid has been wasted. It's been worthy but ineffective. This is not a criticism of the individuals who've been there to try and carry out an aid program, many of whom have been really noble in the things that they've tried to do. But what they've created, rather than a functioning Afghan state, is what the World Bank, in a highly critical report, called an aid juggernaut that had descended on Afghanistan. And in that report, they said, it could be argued that the prominent foreign presence undermines the very objective of building a credible and legitimate Afghan state. So the criticism is that not only is that aid ineffective, it's actually destructive. The parallel state sucks the ability of the Afghan society to create any kind of functioning institutions. All of the good English speakers work for the international community rather than building the state itself. And in 8 years, we have still not created, you know, a graduate school in Kabul. We've been quite good at putting girls into primary school, but we've not been good at what do these 15, 16-year-olds do? What does this country, where most people are under 25, how do we create employment for of a useful sense for young Afghan men, other than taking up the gun and fighting with the Taliban? So I think that we have allowed, therefore, this corrupt state to sort of emerge in the middle under President Karzai. We haven't built up institutions of the state outside his nexus. And if you go into villages quite near Kabul, as I have, and I mean, I was in one only about 2 weeks ago, quite near the capital, in a place where they said, if you stay here beyond about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the Taliban will be back, so make your interview quick. But when you talk to people in those villages about why they now allow the Taliban to come back and why they support the Taliban, it's because Karzai's government has been so corrupt since 2001, because they have to pay for justice. They have to pay the police. 60% of the police in Helmand province in the south are heroin addicts. If you're a police officer in Afghanistan, you get your salary should be about $200 a month. You get about $100 of it because the rest is creamed off by corrupt people along the way. How well motivated do you think that makes those men to try and build law and order within a new society? So there is a, rather than there being a functioning state, which we can be proud of, what Afghans see as being the state supported by US troops is a state that lives on them, that is corrupt, that doesn't provide justice, that hasn't secured land rights. And those are the things that matter to Afghan individuals. And if General McChrystal can talk about protecting civilians, I think the troop numbers is not a huge important part of his program. The really important part of it is a completely different strategy in Afghanistan. If he can do that and at the same time build a less corrupt Afghan state, then there's a chance, just a small chance, that it might not be a complete defeat. But I'll stop there, and we'll move on to what it.
Christina, you know, you've had this kind of very interesting experience of only recently coming to Washington after so much time in Afghanistan. What are you noticing, and where is your thinking on all these issues?
I find myself in a very odd position because I arrived in Washington about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I had dinner with my editor in London just before I left, and he said, I don't want you to just write about Afghanistan from America. Then I arrive in Washington and it's the main issue on the front page every day. So
it's the only story in town.
It is, although I'm quite happy that I haven't had to write about healthcare yet. it's very interesting because I've always been the other end. I've always been on the ground in Afghanistan, Pakistan. Most of my reporting has been very focused on being in villages, being with the people, not being with policymakers. And I've always been slightly baffled by some of the policies that are made and how those decisions are reached. So it's fascinating to actually be in Washington and quite disturbing sometimes because I talked to somebody the other day who is involved in advising on Afghanistan, and I asked him at the end, when was the last time you were there? And he said, well, I've never been there. Right. And I think what's missed in that is one of the things that David just talked about is that for ordinary people in villages in Afghanistan, they are in a situation where I think the majority of people don't want the Taliban to come back. I think we need to accept that the Taliban do represent a certain point of view, and there are people that do support them, but the majority don't want them back. The problem is they're on the fence, and on one side they have the Taliban coming and threatening them, but also offering speedy justice, which is very important in a country where most people have got land disputes after 30 years of war. And on the other side, they've got a government that offers them almost nothing. Most of their interaction with the government is police, who, as David said, are very corrupt. 90% of the police are illiterate. So that gives you a sense of the difficulties, the challenges faced in Afghanistan. And I think I'll just tell you a story that kind of illustrates the situation for people. I have a friend in Logar, which is one of the provinces that borders Kabul. Where he lives is only about 40 minutes drive from Kabul. And he runs an orphanage, and he's been running it for 15 years. He ran it all through the Taliban time. When 9/11 happened and the Taliban fell, he then got visits from lots of aid agencies. We're very happy to find this ready-made orphanage that they could then contribute to. And so he started getting money from UNICEF and other organizations. And he was very happy because it meant he could build a proper building, he could have books and toys and clothes for the children. And although it was, I describe it as an orphanage, in Afghanistan, most people, many families, can't look after their own children because one of the parents has been killed, or the father's lost an eye or a leg and can't work. So actually, a lot of these children were not orphans, but they needed somebody to help look after them. So he was doing tremendous service for the village. Anyway, about a year and a half ago, the Taliban moved into his village, and they came to him and said, you are accepting money from infidel Westerners, and we're going to kill you. So he was terrified, and he went to the mosque where all the villagers gathered, and he said he knew that some of these Taliban in masks were actually local villagers. And he said, look, you know, the Taliban have come and threatened me. I'm going to have to leave. And I look after all your children. What do you want me to do? And they all said, well, we need you. Don't leave. So he said he went back home and he thought about it. And then he looked around and he thought, actually, if the Taliban come and try to kill me, I have nobody to go to. There are no police here. There's nobody to actually protect me. And I have five children of my own. So he fled to Kabul. And when I met him, he was in tears because he said, you know, I've looked after these kids for all these years. I don't know what's going to happen to them. But how can I go back and risk my family? I just can't trust that the Afghan government will do anything for me. And that is the dilemma, I think, that people are in.
I have to say, when Christina and I were last on a platform together at the Cheltenham Book Festival in England about a year ago, I think people were virtually slitting their wrists by the end. We outdid each other with gloom and pessimism about how bad things were going to become. So let's...
But let me ask the two of you something about that, because not only for the reasons you said, but in terms of recent events, right? Karzai is now embroiled in this ballot box stuffing scandal. The Taliban, for all their incorruptibility, are now deeply embedded in the opium trade. There's a kind of corrupting effect on this side of the water as well, where you have General McChrystal effectively debating his own commander-in-chief, leaking a report and then presenting a very challenging position in a public speech outside the chain of command, and Democrats arguing among themselves. Maybe one of the reasons for this is that, well, David, you said, well, the war is still winnable. The question is, what is winnable? And, or maybe, since both of you have reported for so long from there, what do each of you think is the best reasonable attainable outcome? What is there to shoot for that's real and possible?
I think there's a big risk now that defeat and victory are beginning to look rather similar. The gap between what's doable and humiliating withdrawal, you know, both of which will leave an undeveloped country and a country where the Taliban or their like will have a very substantial role, which I think is sort of the ultimate outcome one way or another. So I think we've lost possibly the opportunity, which was unique opportunity in 2001 to build a different kind of society. But that may not be the end of it. I mean, I think if there were within 5 or 6 years some kind of a negotiated settlement with the Taliban for the south, that if the international community could be much more better coordinated, then there are some things that are working in Afghanistan. I was in a town a couple of weeks ago doing a story about how mobile phones are going to end corruption, because I described before how police officers get about half of the salary that they're given. Well, there's only 53 police so far are paid in this way, so it's not yet. It's still a pilot project, but there's a mobile phone company called Roshan, which is a privately owned organization, not a government-owned organization, which is now running a pilot project that police can, with a SIM number, an identity number, can the money is put into their mobile phone account. They don't even need a bank account. It's put into their credit account on their mobile phone, and then they can take it out in any mobile phone shop anywhere in Afghanistan, or indeed their family can, because one of the problems with the police is that it's a good job to have, but they need to desert every few weeks in order to take money back to their village to give it to their family. Well, if their mother could use the same system, then suddenly you're using a very modern scheme to completely end corruption in the police force, which might be one of those doable things. But when I went to this town, which is quite near Kabul, to do this story, which the mobile phone company had put me onto, I found a new road being built, and small realtors in huts on street corners trading land. Now, as Christina described, land rights are one of the big arguments. Who knows quite what they were trading, but there were people who were, it was a real pioneering feeling to it. So there are opportunities, but that thin sliver of opportunity between, I think, what's a doable success, at least in the cities, and total humiliating withdrawal is narrowing all the time. And if you have, one of the most really depressing things in Afghanistan this year is the sacking of Peter Galbraith, the most senior American civilian outside the U.S. embassy, who was the number two at the UN, who was sacked for saying that the United Nations should have taken a far stronger line on fraud. And this is not the fraud he was talking about. Was not just a few people here or there, a bit of ballot box stuffing. It was counting results from polling stations that we know were closed on polling day.
Even Chicago.
Literally places which were either too insecure or hadn't been opened, and still those counts went through. And he said, look, there are many things that we might not take a view on, but actually this should stop. And for Qaeda, the head of the UN, to remain in place, and the man who blew the whistle on that to be the one sacked, I think sends all the wrong signals.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think also it particularly sends a bad signal to the people who voted for Abdullah and people in the north, because it feels as though their views don't count, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's some kind of reaction to that. I don't agree with David, however, on the whether this is winnable. I think it's not. I think one of the huge problems is that we've lost the consent of the Afghan people, and I think that is almost impossible now to get back. One of the big differences between the war in Iraq, which I also covered, and the war in Afghanistan, was that when the troops went into Iraq, they were right from the start regarded as a kind of occupying force. In Afghanistan, when the first foreign troops came in after the Taliban had fallen, and it was actually British Royal Marines that came into Kabul, they were absolutely welcomed. People had had almost 30 years of Afghans fighting Afghans, and they thought only foreigners could actually come and sort this out. They thought that these people were going to come and take on the warlords who had caused all the problems for them in the first place and led to the Taliban being formed. None of those things happened. As David described, the aid effort was really a disaster. And what happened instead was that people started feeling that Afghan views were not being taken into account. They saw all these promises had been made to them, all this money coming into the country, and yet it seemed to go on big air-conditioned offices and jeeps for NGOs and different groups and not to them. There are also, particularly in the early years, a lot of not respecting their culture, a lot of troops going into women's quarters, smashing doors down in the middle of the night, taking dogs, which are regarded as unclean, into people's houses, and really totally neglecting, ignoring their cultural feelings. And also several incidents where wedding parties were bombed, because at weddings in Afghanistan, people shoot a lot. And so the international troops at the beginning thought that this was firing and the threat on them. And so there were several incidents where lots of people at wedding parties were killed. And this, of course, turned the local population against the international forces. And this is, particularly in the south, a culture where revenge is a very important part of life. If your brother or father or son is killed, it's your duty to kill somebody from the family that did that. Then it's their duty to kill someone from your family back. And so it will go on for years. So we created a lot more enemies. And, of course, the Taliban, who I think have been much cleverer in their strategy in recent years than we have, and particularly their information campaign, have seized on this and said to people, you know, this is just another occupying force, and look at what they're doing. And in a country like Afghanistan, which has never been conquered, this is a very emotive thing to say, and it's very easy to get people to rally behind that. And I think it's extremely difficult, whatever General McChrystal does now, to change that. And the only way that you could really win support of people back is if they saw that their own lives were genuinely improving. And that's very difficult, because in many of these areas now, the situation is so bad that it's very difficult to do any aid work or development. And there are just sort of crazy examples in Helmand, which British are rather obsessed by because that's where our troops are. But you have 20,000 troops there now, 10,000 or 9,000 Brits and about 10 or 11,000 American troops fighting to control a really quite small area. And you go to some areas like Nowzad, which is a small district town, and all the population fled a couple of years ago in all the fighting, and they're all living in tents outside of Lashkargah as refugees. And then you've got a group of American soldiers in a base in Nowzad who can't go more than a few hundred yards without being attacked by the Taliban. And you go there and you think, what is this for? You know, these soldiers are risking their lives in this small place. The population have all gone. It just seems so pointless.
Let me ask you both a journalism-related question, and then we'll go to questions from the floor. But you both have been reporting from Afghanistan and Pakistan and the region for a long time. Let me put you on the spot a little bit. What's something in your reporting, or if not in yours, then in Western reporting generally, but maybe yours, that you've gotten wrong about Afghanistan, and what's interesting and important about it? What have you taken away from that?
I won't put my own hand up. I do think there was a really serious. It's a very interesting question, and I think. I hinted at this in my opening remarks. I think the view in 2000, 2001 that the Taliban were some uniquely evil phenomenon, and that the Mujahideen, you know, the Northern Alliance, who we had backed in the 1980s against the Russians, were all good guys, led to a really serious gulf in understanding. So that when, you'll remember the pictures, you know, when the Taliban fell in November 2001 in Kabul, the Royal Marines arrived and were the first foreign troops on the ground. Lots of journalists arrived. There were quite a flood of journalists flowed into Kabul, and all of the initial reporting was how women were flinging off their burqas, and there was an image built up by the press who were there that somehow normal life would be restored, that, you know, democracy would return, the Taliban had gone, there'd be a McDonald's on every street corner, and peace and justice would flow, you know. And, of course, it wasn't like that, and women didn't fling off their burqas in the way described, although a few did. And clearly, look, Kabul is a nicer place now than it was under the Taliban. I mean, boys can fly kites again and can listen to music. There are many women who do not cover their heads walking around a very small part of the center of town. But broadly, nothing very much changed. And I think Western policy was skewed into thinking that these were good guys. Christina described in one of her pieces how there were warlords who were surprised at how much money they were being given by the West at the time, you know, and they said, well, thank you very much indeed. But there was a real sense of Western U.S. policymakers going into Afghanistan and sort of from the very beginning treating it as just a counterterrorism story, that if they shoveled enough money into the pockets of enough people, then the Taliban wouldn't return and everything would be all right. And I do actually blame journalism a bit for creating that worldview. I mean, I blame the State Department as well for not having a single individual who spoke Pashto on September the 11th, 2001, and they suddenly had to find a few.
Christina, anything? Either your own or at large?
Well, no, I mean, I can make an admission, which is that for some years I used to argue very passionately at forums like this that we should send more troops to Afghanistan. I used to argue it everywhere because I felt really strongly that at the beginning, after the Taliban fell, there was only 4,500 troops as peacekeepers. They were only in Kabul. They weren't allowed to go outside of Kabul. I think this is one of the big mistakes. And there was about 19,000 troops under this parallel operation, Operation Enduring Freedom, whose only interest was to hunt down bin Laden and al-Qaeda, not in actually stabilizing the country, nor in the Taliban at that point. And I felt very strongly that there needed to be far more troops. Now, I think as recently as 2004, there were only 6,500 troops. This increase of troops is very, very recent. So I was arguing we needed to send more. I was arguing that all of last year, really, until about September of last year. And then I went back again to Afghanistan. And suddenly we had stepped up the numbers a lot over that year, and the situation had got far, far worse. I found that I could travel to far fewer places. For the last few years, every time I've gone back, I've been more restricted to the places I could actually go to, and that's true for ordinary Afghans trying to travel around. I mean, the information minister told me last year that he hadn't been to his own village, which is only 90 minutes outside of Kabul, for a year and a half because it was too dangerous. So I felt very strongly that we needed to send more troops and they needed to go to more places. But the fact is, the more troops we've sent, the worse the situation has got. And I suppose I would argue if we sent a huge number, such as 400,000 or 500,000, that could really deal with the threat, then it would be a good policy. But sending 20,000 more or 40,000 more, I think it's just going to cause more casualties. And I used to go and talk to British troops quite a lot before they went out because they wanted to speak to somebody who knew the culture of Afghanistan. And I thought it was useful for me because I would hear their views. And then if I went and embedded with them, I already knew them. The last time I did it was in November of last year with a regiment called Two Rifle. And as I was speaking to them, I just thought, I can no longer argue that what you're doing is actually useful. And I decided that I was never going to do one of those talks again. I stayed with the commander that night. His wife at breakfast the next morning was asking him what arrangements he'd made for bereavement counselling for the wives of the soldiers. That regiment has subsequently lost more soldiers than any other regiment of the British regiment. They lost 8 in 1 week alone. So I do feel I got it wrong on troops. I really do.
Can I quote something that a Pravda correspondent wrote in 1981? Upon completing an operation, the Afghan-Soviet troops, as a rule, return to their bases and the regions fall back under the control of the rebels. In the course of these operations, housing and the agricultural fields are often destroyed, the civilian population is killed, and in the end, everything remains the same. And I think that what Christina's describing is you know, there's that problem in the south to this day. And by the way, you know, if you think I'm too obsessed with the history of the country, the Taliban know it. They wear scarves which they see as tokens of a woman called Malalai, who was a heroine of the Battle of Maiwand, the only time the British were actually defeated in the field in Afghanistan in 1880. And they recruit young men in the south by saying, do you want to be remembered as a son of Dost Mohammed or a son of Shah Shuja? And Shah Shuja was the puppet that British troops put on the throne in 1838, and Dost Mohammed was the man who dislodged him. And, of course, in their eyes, Shah Shuja is Karzai, and Dost Mohammed is their leader, Mullah Omar, the only two men who've ever gone to the most sacred site in Afghanistan, a mosque in Kandahar, which houses the country's holiest relic, a cloak believed to have belonged to the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and have... Both Dost Mohammed and Mullah Omar, Dost Mohammed in the 1830s, Mullah Omar in the spring of 1996, took this cloak out of the box, declared themselves Amir al-Mumineen, leader not just of the Afghans, king not just of Afghanistan, but leader of all the Muslims, and made their insurrection a holy war, a jihad. And that power is a very strong one for these young men, and it's an extraordinary inspiration for them.
So I think we should go to questions and answers. Let me suggest this. We need you to go to the mic and line up. When you ask your question, A, make it a question. B, keep it brief out of civility and courtesy to all our friends here in the room. And third, identify yourself for the microphone, for the tape, for posterity. And do remember that this is going to be at some point available on the Internet. So don't embarrass yourself. Okay. Sir.
David Quansel, lifelong learner, Columbia program. My question is directed to both of you, ladies and gentlemen.
Speak into the mic, if you would.
You put it down a bit.
Can you possibly shed any light why, after so many years and so many victims, did the American technology did not equip the armored vehicles with remote detectors capable to identify the presence of road bombs in Afghanistan?
Well, I think they're working very hard on that. That is the single biggest killer, and they're trying very hard to find ways of detecting and to improve their protection. But one of the problems in the south is that the terrain is so bad that if you have a really heavily protected vehicle, it can't really maneuver in the kind of sands and things that you've got to cross. So you've got to have some kind of midway between safety and being able to actually get around.
But I'm sure you know that this goes back quite a few years to Iraq as well. So God knows by now we have maybe 14 years or 12 years of what should have been intense research by the geniuses in the American technology field.
Thank you, sir.
It isn't asymmetric warfare clever? I mean, that's just how it works.
Simon Aiken with the New York Times. Again, a question for both David and Christina. Do you think the narrative that British armed forces had some kind of deeper understanding of counterinsurgency, of which we heard so much in 2001-2, has that completely unraveled now, do you think?
I think it's a very good question, because the British certainly annoyed their U.S. comrades by going into Afghanistan and Iraq and saying, you know, we have the answer to this. You know, Malaya, the Dhofar emergency in the Gulf, you know, Northern Ireland, Bosnia. The British troops lost far fewer than any other European nation. You know, we're the counterinsurgency army, best little army in the world, and all this kind of stuff. And actually, at the end of the day, I think they haven't learned the lessons of the new war. There's been, I mean, I think there's a very curious disjunction in Britain between military thinking. You know, General Rupert Smith has written what's now become the textbook of the new age, a book called The Utility of Force, which overturns Clausewitzian ideas of what armies are for, and tries to write about this new world of what he calls war amongst the people. But it was blown away by David Kilcullen and General Petraeus' counterinsurgency doctrine, a really interesting read, you know, available online, you know, the U.S. Being a wonderful country for being all that kind of thing being open. And I think the U.S. armed forces, in my personal experience, at a low level, have been much more flexible and a far more sophisticated learning institution, far more willing to criticize themselves and to learn lessons from their mistakes. They stay in the field for far longer. And I think any idea that the British Army has some unique answer in counterinsurgency is proven by the fact that that frankly, in Helmand, they've been as successful or not as anybody else.
And in particular, is the six-month tour too short, do you think, that we operate our battalions?
I think it is, but if you've got a very small army, yeah. It's really hard to do anything else. And the way the British Army operates is, you know, they move into their Afghan rotation about 18 months before they go there, and so they do a lot of other training. They spend a lot of time with families. They spend some time in Kenya in doing training in hot weather climate, and it is a really, really tough place to live. I think they're pretty knackered after 6 months.
Although they are planning to increase the length of tours now. I mean, because one of the problems is 6 months. It's not actually 6 months. I mean, by the time they get all the troops there and then it ends up only being about 4 months in some cases that they're actually on the ground. So I think that made a lot of difference that the American troops were there often for a year or 13 months at a time. And some of those troops are now on their third tour back, so they've actually spent 3 years in country. And they tend to go back to the same place too. So they have a real understanding of local dynamics. And that is so important in Afghanistan, because you need to know who is who. A lot of this fighting isn't Taliban, it's tribes. And I think that's been one of the big problems in media coverage and also in how ISAF and American forces have reported things, because they've tended to always say there's been Taliban attacks, or we've killed so many Taliban. And we journalists have also reported it like that, because it's complicated describing different tribes. And a lot of the time it hasn't been. It's just local tribes fighting with each other. And, of course, the Taliban are never going to deny responsibility for anything, because they want to look as powerful as possible. And the other confusion, I mean, I was just saying to Bruce, I was shocked in the Washington Post's editorial yesterday, which talked about the links between the Afghan and Pakistan Taliban. The Afghan Taliban and Pakistan Taliban are quite distinct. I mean, the Pakistan Taliban are interested in Pakistan, and the Afghan Taliban are interested in Afghanistan. And the Afghan Taliban were quite angry when Baitullah Masood, the leader of the biggest Pakistan Taliban group, started launching attacks inside Pakistan, because they felt that that was going to jeopardize their ability to use Pakistan as a sanctuary.
Thank you.
Billy Freeland, SIPA. I wanted to first thank you both for your reporting from Afghanistan. And I wanted to pick up on something Mr. Loyne said, which was about that it's not the number of troops that's key, it's about how you use those troops. But my impression was that there was a big difference between 108 or 118,000 and 68,000 in terms of what you can actually do with the number of troops. And I wanted to sort of press you on that and ask you to develop that thought a little bit in terms of how we train the ANA and the ANP, how we protect the populations. How would executing that strategy be no different or different with the 40,000 soldier increase as McChrystal has proposed versus not doing that?
I think, as Christina said before, any counterinsurgency mathematics for Afghanistan means to fight a counterinsurgency classical in the classical sense and win it would need 300,000 to 400,000 troops. Now, including local troops, but the Afghan National Army is by no means as good as the Soviet-backed troops that were put together in the late 1980s. Remember that when the Russian army pulled out in 1989, January 1989, their government succeeded in remaining in power for a further 3 years against a really substantial Mujahideen fighting. And in fact, in the summer of 1989, the battle for Jalalabad was one of the toughest battles of the war. There were Mujahideen units who lost far more men in that set-piece battle, Stalingrad-type fighting, than in all of the years of the skirmishes against the Russian forces. So, you know, those forces were pretty effective, and we failed to provide anything like a united army of that quality. And as both of us just described, the police are really pretty poor, both nationally and locally. So, I think, you know, we're a long way away from a really effective force. I mean, yes, with 40,000 more, you could do better training, which is certainly one of the key things. I think we'll see in the next coming months huge pressure on other NATO countries, particularly Germany and France, to put more troops in to Afghanistan and to allow them to go into harm's way, because there are a whole series of caveats, so-called, which prevent a really effective use of the even the forces that are in Afghanistan, because most European nations won't allow their troops to be put into harm's way, with the exception of Britain and the Netherlands, significantly, and a few plucky new nations. Estonia has now got a detachment of troops alongside the British in the south, including a colonel who was in Afghanistan, I understand, as a conscript during the Russian War, who must be one of the only people in recent years who have invaded the same country twice with different armies. So I think, you know, there will be a huge pressure on those NATO countries. My point about the 40,000 was that I think the key to McChrystal's plan is not just the number of troops. Of course, he's a general, so he says, "Can I have some more troops, please?" But the completely different view that he has of how the thing should be configured, how the fighting should be done, and indeed how the civil-military coordination should be done better.
I apologize for this, but is the increase then essential to execute the strategy properly, or can you remain at 68,000 and execute the strategy?
Well, I think that's Obama's big call, and he has to have that conversation. I mean, clearly there's a huge amount of politics in getting another 40,000 troops. It's and McChrystal has put a lot on the line in terms of because of his London speech and because of his interviews, in saying that he wants them. But I think what's really interesting is that this administration has not come out strongly on that side. All the indications are that both Hillary Clinton and Gates for defense and state are not so enamored with sending lots and lots more young men in necessarily, unless we really know what they're doing, young men and women.
Thank you. Thank you.
Jim Dingman, INN World Report. One of the things you just raised when you talked about the Taliban in the South wearing scarves about my wand is the fact that essentially the press internationally has minimized any kind of nationalism in its coverage of the Taliban or, for example, what's going on in Pakistan. We get none of that or little of that from the press. That is, that there's a nationalist component to it. We only get the image of they're a bunch of fanatical Islamic jihadists. And that's been a weakness since 9/11 in our understanding of what's going on in the South. Secondly, the question following on this gentleman's question is the question of the expansion of the Afghani army and the national police. We get little snapshots in the press from 2001. I've had friends of mine who've either served there as soldiers or as journalists come back and give me sort of negative impressions of the police, the army. You know, they train the guys for 10 weeks. They go off. They basically desert. Come back, re-up for more money. And the public doesn't really have a sense of that at all, of the totality of that. You know, and I think of Vietnam, when, you know, at least we had some reporting at the district level, which didn't have the same dangers as this obviously has. And I wanted you to comment on that, because it just seems that in general, aside from, you know, and I've read both your reporting over the years, and I've enjoyed it tremendously, but there's just it just is very difficult for the public in the West to understand at a grassroots level what's going on in any kind of systematic way.
There's been some really good American reporting. Sebastian Unger and Tim Hetherington's stuff in Vanity Fair has been very much, you know, from district level the way you describe. In terms of, you know, the Taliban as a nationalist group as against, you know, al-Qaeda, it's certainly something that I've stressed in my reporting over the years. But I think there's a real danger now that the two are becoming closer and closer aligned. The Taliban never had any international strategy whatsoever. I mean, from the mid-90s, I was very struck. I mean, I think, as far as I know, the only journalist with them when they actually took Kabul in 1996. And I was struck, the people I was with at the time, by how little they cared about the outside world. They really did only care about taking this country and stabilizing it and pacifying it, and they didn't have any interest in the outside world. And in fact, I think it was one of their diplomatic failings at the beginning, and as Christina described, since then they've become far more internationalist, but that also means that they've become, in many ways, more aligned with this international jihadi movement. And I think it's become more difficult to talk to. I personally think that talking to the Taliban should be an essential part of any coherent strategy, because you're going to have to negotiate with these guys at some point. Picking off the moderates won't work. You don't make peace with people who are willing to lay down their guns. You make durable peace with your enemy. That's all the experience of successful ending of counterinsurgency, particularly Northern Ireland, leads. That's one of the real lessons, is you make peace with your enemy, however hard it might be. But it's becoming a difficult thing to do, because a huge amount of their recruitment and their interest is from young men who are attracted to them because they want to have a go at the United States, because they have an irreconcilable global jihadi idea which is far tougher to negotiate with.
Christina, do you see it that way?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. The Taliban put on their website yesterday a statement saying that we're not interested in attacking the West, we're just interested in Afghanistan. And I thought that was quite clever timing, because obviously at the moment, the justification, well, I think one of the big problems that the West and people like Obama have is they don't have a proper narrative for why we're in Afghanistan. They can't argue. Obama, when he talks about, is it demolishing, dismantling, destroying al-Qaeda, has a big problem in arguing that that's a reason for sending troops to Afghanistan, because al-Qaeda is in Pakistan, not Afghanistan. I don't think anybody seriously believes that any of the al-Qaeda leadership is currently in Afghanistan, but to me this is a sort of unspoken issue here, is because nobody really knows what to do about Pakistan, it's easier to focus on Afghanistan, but actually the real problem is over the border. And we have a strange situation in Britain, because we have had our Prime Minister and Foreign Minister repeatedly saying 70% of terror plots in Britain are linked to Pakistan. Not a single one is linked to Afghanistan. Mm. So why should our troops be in Afghanistan?
Thank you. Yes.
Hello, my name is Catherine Brown. I'm a PhD student here at the Journalism School, and I'm actually interested in hearing your thoughts about your Afghan counterparts, the Afghan press, and some of the their ability to really serve as watchdogs to the Afghan government, international community, and some of the limitations they've had in doing their jobs, and also some successes, if any.
It's a real success story. It's one of the few success stories since 2001. There's a new generation of really bright young journalists, some of them pretty well trained. There's been a lot of money from things like BBC World Service Trust, but you know, other organizations as well, who have encouraged a new group of journalists who do want to do exactly the kinds of things you describe. They are in many ways trying to hold their government account more successfully than in the neighbouring Central Asian republics. And in some ways, I mean, Pakistan has had the same sort of great huge flowering of new media in the last few years. In some ways, they sort of reflect that. And it goes into quite successful TV stations as well. There's an Afghan TV station that is now translating American TV sitcoms and movies for the Iranian market, you know, because they speak basically the same language. So this is a new media and an export industry, And I was very struck. I was in Afghanistan when Steve Farrell, the New York Times correspondent, was kidnapped for a few days by the Taliban, and in a botched rescue attempt, his Afghan colleague, Sultan Manadi, was killed by the British SAS, I guess, but or in crossfire in that incident. And I went to his funeral, and I was struck by the righteous anger of Afghan journalists who, because of the reporting, actually particularly in the New York Times here, where he was described as a translator, you know, Steve Farrell and his Afghan translator. Any of us who travel there know that these locals who we work with, the fixers, local producers, are absolutely the key part of the story. I mean, the BBC couldn't do any journalism from Afghanistan without fantastic local people. And the protests that were made by the new Afghan Journalists Union was all the kind of thing that you would have in a Western country. So it's an interesting success story and should be really encouraged.
I'm very biased because I'm on the board of an organization called the Institute of War and Peace Reporting, and we train journalists in Afghanistan. So, of course, I think it's a success story, too.
Well, but Christina, what's gone well and what's been more challenging in the work that IWPR has done in Afghanistan? Because it's interesting. Yeah. There have been some challenges.
Yeah, it's been, I mean, it's difficult for women journalists particularly, and they've had lots of threats, and, you know, it's an issue that isn't really resolved because, you know, are we training them to do something that is then putting them more at risk? And some of them have had to go into hiding, and it's extremely difficult. And there also have been issues in Helmand where we had a project that was partly funded by the Foreign Office, which I think it's one of the difficulties for some of the media training organizations. And the journalists there were reporting on abuses by the British troops, which were then denied. I don't know to this day whether the stories were true or not, but the funding was then pulled by the Foreign Office. So it is very difficult. I think that TV has been the biggest success, really, rather than print in Afghanistan, and Tolo TV in particular, which has produced Afghanistan's most popular program, the Afghan Pop Idol, has done an amazing job.
Yeah, but the producer of that then had to flee the country after it was broadcast.
We try and write positive stories. Actually, I have a funny story. Last time I was there in August, because I knew I was coming to be based here, I thought, I probably won't be in Afghanistan for a while. I really want to do a positive story. And it was also summer, and our desk were wanting kind of light stories. So I was looking around for something light, and I had heard about this project to bring skateboarding to Afghanistan. It's called Skatistan. And so I went to talk to the organizer, who's an Australian, Ollie, and he said to me, oh, yeah, it's great. We have boys and girls skateboarding together, have street kids, rich kids, Tajiks, Uzbeks, Pashtuns, all different groups, and it's really good. So we arranged that I would go with a photographer to see them, and the first thing that went wrong was the place where they used to skateboard every afternoon was this empty fountain at Estate Makrorayon. So he phones me the morning that we were supposed to go there, and he said that the locals had got fed up with the noise of the children skateboarding and had filled in the fountain. So he had to find somewhere else. Eventually, he decided to take them to this swimming pool that the Soviets built, which is on top of a hill in Kabul and is also empty. So we went there, and we arrived, and sure enough, the kids turned up in a van, and it was as promised. They were all skateboarding, laughing. It was great, because you so rarely see kids actually playing in Afghanistan, and particularly to have boys and girls together. So I thought, this is really nice, and so I was interviewing them all. Then this girl came up in tears and said that one of the boys had taken her skateboard. Well, fine, that would happen maybe anywhere. Except that this boy and his friends had all got knives, and within a short time, they'd taken all the skateboards and were then threatening the guy running the project, demanding that he handed over his van and money. And we basically all had to flee for our lives. And that was my positive story.
Thanks for that, Christina.
Sorry.
Sir.
My name is Rehan Rafi Jamil. I'm a first-year student here at SIPA. You can't really talk about the situation in Afghanistan without talking about my country, Pakistan. And we've been part of the problem in that country, as you both know, and I think are part of the solution as well. And one of the things, at least the perception in Pakistan increasingly is, that this is a neo-colonial enterprise, and this is looked at as a U.S. occupation, which fuels the Taliban in both Pakistan, where we have a huge situation on our hands internally, and in Afghanistan. So I wanted to get your perceptions on that, because one of the things is this new great game and the talk about not just, you know, it's so easy to talk about the Taliban as if they're this one amorphous group, and I think both of you pointed that out. It's incredibly complex. There's the Pakistani Taliban, which is, again, different groups, and some of the more nuanced analysis talks about this. There's the Afghan Taliban. There's a lot of talk in Pakistan now of foreign, the foreign Taliban, which is the Indian involvement in supporting, and other. A little bit about, from the Pakistani, our perception in Pakistan, or one of the major is that this, you know, as long as this is viewed as an occupation, there will be a resistance. And a second part to that, this idea that, you know, the people of Afghanistan welcomed the Taliban, I think David mentioned that. It's sort of misleading. Afghanistan, like Pakistan, is a complex country. Maybe in Kabul they did, but Kandahar, Helmand, and this idea that, you know, in Pakistan and even in parts of Afghanistan, you hear people saying that Pashtuns are under attack, southern Afghanistan, where the resistance is now, and the NWFP in Pakistan. You know, so there's this perception in the region, and I was wondering what your thoughts, both of your thoughts, are on this perception.
I'm really glad you've raised that. I think it's so important. There is so little understanding outside of the view inside Pakistan. Pakistan, I lived there in the late 80s. I must declare a great interest. I have a kind of love-hate relationship with Pakistan because I've been deported twice by a military intelligence. But
I should have, when I said David was called up for treason, well, I should have mentioned that. I'm so sorry.
But I've always been invited back. So, and some of my closest friends are in Pakistan. But I think that there is... let me just explain. When I went to live there in 87, I was 21. It was the first time of going as a foreign correspondent anywhere, and people were so hospitable. I mean, I lived there for 2-3 years. I was a woman on my own. I had no money, so I used to travel on local buses, go stay in people's houses. People could not have been more friendly, more hospitable. It was just incredible. Never once was I under any threat or anything. Now I'm afraid it's totally different. I was in Peshawar last in June, and I felt scared. I mean, this is the same place where I lived and wandered all around in the city. There is so much anti-Western feeling. A lot of it is our own doing. There's a strong feeling in Pakistan that Pakistan has been used and abandoned, which is true. Pakistan has also, its military has played a very interesting double game over the years and has succeeded in pulling the wool over the eyes of the West for quite a long time, and I think is still trying to do it. I think people are justified in feeling that they are suffering in Pakistan because of the Western troops in Afghanistan, but I think also a lot of the suicide bombings. I think I'm right in saying Pakistan has more than any other country now, including Iraq. A lot of that is because of what Pakistan's own military has been doing in sponsoring jihadist groups, using them to fight in Kashmir or Afghanistan. And you can't, over the years, create all these organizations and then not think that that won't come back to haunt you at some point. So I think Pakistan's in a very difficult position, because I'm not entirely sure, even if the military leadership want to really take on all the Taliban, I'm not convinced that they do, but if they did, that they can actually control all these groups. There's no doubt that people in senior military positions still divide up Taliban between good and bad and see some of them as assets. I had a senior general telling me quite recently that they regarded Jalaluddin Haqqani, who is one of the most vicious Afghan warlords, very linked to al-Qaeda, as an asset, and that the Afghan Taliban caused them no problems, so why should they take them on? And obviously, if that is the attitude inside Pakistan, that is very difficult for us to ever succeed in Afghanistan, because as long as that sanctuary is there, I think it's really difficult to really defeat the Taliban. So it's a key issue, and I don't think enough is being done to try and actually change public opinion in Pakistan. There is, I'm sure you know, there's a big debate going on in the media there around anti-Americanism, a lot of discussion of the Americans taking over lots of houses in Islamabad, DynCorp coming in, training people, and the big aid package that was given last week of $1.5 billion a year, civilian aid, has got various conditions, such as Pakistan cracking down on terrorist groups, but also that the military don't take over again. So, you know, there's a lot of feeling that there is still Western interference, and I think public opinion did change quite a lot in Pakistan over the whole SWAT issue, but I don't think that that means that people are actually going to support action in other places. I guess Waziristan, which is being talked about at the moment, is a test. In my view, SWAT was quite different because SWAT was where affluent Pakistanis went on holiday, and the idea that the Taliban were taking over SWAT caused outrage, and there was also a video that went all around Pakistan of a young girl being lashed by Taliban, and that really shocked people. Up till then, I think the media had been pretty pro-Taliban in Pakistan, and that seemed to change people's point of view. But I do think that it's restricted to certain groups of Taliban and not Taliban in general. I'd be interested to hear your views on that.
Let me just interject here and say that we have maybe 15 minutes before the event gods start to frown on us. And I want to make sure that everybody who has a question gets to ask one and be part of this important conversation. So please continue, but keep your questions brief. And David and Christina?
Your answer's brief.
My name is Simone Foxman, aspiring journalist and junior in the college. And I just had a question. We've talked a lot about the military, what we can do militarily to try and succeed or not succeed in Afghanistan. What kind of government do you think the people would rally behind in Afghanistan? What are the elements of a successful government? Does it include democracy, or does it include some kind of Sharia law that's a little bit different, maybe like that exists in Morocco? What do you think?
A clean, non-corrupt government that they could deal with fairly. Absolutely, you know. And I mean, I mentioned land rights and justice. The general problems that people have with in dealing with disputes with their neighbours that they have to pay for. And I mean, democracy is not something people demand. And in fact, there's a very strong philosophical argument in Afghanistan that democracy in an Islamic country is not possible. But you know, they've got democracy, and you do hear in villages people saying, well, look, we voted, and you know, so could we please have the people we voted for, and could we have all the arguments about this election sorted out? And Parliament, the Afghan Parliament, is sort of beginning to work. There are arguments that are going on within Parliament, and people bring petitions to Parliament, and they believe that it's working. But at the moment, there is a sort of mafia nexus that is so strong around the presidency in particular, and the relationship that people have with local government is so weak, and the international community's understanding of how to change those things is so pathetic, that we're a long way away from, you know, those rather simple things. People in Afghanistan want what people anywhere want, which is to be treated fairly.
Yeah, also, it's an incredibly poor country. The majority of people don't have water, don't have electricity, don't have education, and they want those things. I don't think I ever heard anybody after the Taliban fell saying, what we need is elections. What they wanted was kind of just basic human rights, and, well, not even human rights. I mean, they just wanted to be able to sort of feed and clothe their children. And unfortunately, after 8 years, still that isn't the case in most of the country. Even in Kabul, the capital city, majority of people still don't have water or electricity.
There are 180 countries in the world, and Afghanistan is 176 on the Transparency International Index, and it's slipped down over the last 2 years. So, you know, for what are we there?
Hi, my name is Juliana. I'm from UNICEF, actually, and I'm really curious to hear your story. Christina was very moving about this man with this orphanage, and I mean, this aid juggernaut is such an issue. And when we work, you know, working with like locals in Afghanistan, it puts them under this threat. But then, if we take it away from locals, then it becomes this, like you were saying before, this juggernaut that is not actually developing anything. So, what is this happy medium? Almost, how do we get?
Solve the problem in 25 words or less.
I know. I'm so sorry. That's a huge question.
Crucial.
I'm really curious.
I mean, if you were talking to the British government, they would have an answer. I mean, I work for a state finance but independent broadcaster. I don't speak for the British government, but I do happen to agree that the way that they do their aid is better than more preferable to the way that the United States does its aid, which is through the government system. You know, 60% of Afghan teacher salaries are paid for by my tax dollars, but paid by British government money. 80% of the government that comes from the money that comes from the British government goes through the Afghan government, and the British government is Afghanistan's largest bilateral donor in terms of the government itself. It's not, I mean, Japan and the United States outstrip Britain in terms of the money that they spend, but most of it goes back to Japan and the United States, is used very ineffectively. So I think there are things apart from funding the local NGO and you know, funding merely international NGOs, and that is building, listening to middle-ranking Afghan civil servants and asking them what they want. It's pretty boring stuff, actually, but it's the simple stuff that ultimately might work.
And also training people rather than sending expensive consultants. I mean, that's one thing I think the Soviets actually did. They sent a lot of people to Soviet Union to be trained as engineers, doctors, administrators. And ironically, the people that today are regarded as the best administrators, such as the governor of Helmand, are people who were trained by the Russians.
Crucial. Sir.
Thank you. Good evening. It's an honor to be here. My name is Robert Wallenstein. I'm an unemployed server and barista and a freelance journalist from Hungary. David, you said you think it's an absolutely winnable war. Christina, you doubt this. I don't know which one of you is right, but I would love to understand what would happen if you're right or you're right. So in short, like, I live in Hungary most of the time, and I don't really know what's what would be the aftermath or the stake of the whole war. Thank you.
Well, I think, as I said before, I think the danger is that victory and defeat will look like the same as the country, you know, slides further and further, and we become less and less. I mean, I think it is winnable, but I don't think the United States has currently got the political will to stay and do what's needed. A British general of the same sort of level as McChrystal at the same sort of time last year, when British generals were coming out in public and doing interviews about what they thought should happen, said our politicians need to realize that we have to be there for 30 years. That's how long dealing with counterinsurgencies takes. Now, you know, given that the midterms here seem to be the dominating factor in whether Obama does or doesn't, you know, put another 30, 40,000 troops in, I think you have a very different sort of political idea. I don't know whether the American political class has the will to do what needs to be done. I think it is winnable, but it's jolly hard.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose we have to define what winning is, don't we? I mean, what kind of Afghanistan, as people say, the central government has never really had much control over the provinces, and maybe we need to be kind of scaling down expectations, and I don't know. I think at the beginning there was all these people that went in and thought they were going to create a sort of Sweden, and people that went in and set up NGOs that were dealing with issues that weren't at all relevant to Afghan life, and we have to accept
gender
the kind
awareness
of
workshops.
Yes, gender awareness, for example.
Yeah.
We have to accept that they have their own traditional systems that have worked for them for hundreds of years, and we might not like them. For example, it's very common for disputes to be resolved by a young girl being handed over as compensation to another family. And that I find horrible, and I've interviewed some of these young girls who have fled. But that is how Afghanistan works, and maybe we just have to live with that.
Yes.
My name is Iman Malik, and I'm from SIPA, second year concentrating in international security policy. I'm originally from Quetta, Pakistan, and when you were escorted by the intelligence agencies out of Serena Hotel, I was living next to you. I still have your pictures and your notes that I took out of that plane and, you know, gave it to CNN to publish. And your associate was, I think, Justin.
That's
yes,
right. Yes, exactly.
So my question to both of you is, like, world is so small. Lot of, like, different schools of thoughts, academia, a lot of experts are talking about, very strongly talking about the disintegration of Pakistan and, like, the creation of Pashtunistan along the Durand Line. So how would you perceive that notion, and what are your thoughts about that?
I don't think the Pakistani army will let that happen.
Yes, that's true, but, like, because of the internal threats and, like, the Talibanization within the Pakistan armed forces. So, like, you know, there are a lot of kind
if
of strings attached to
this can be answered in short sentences,
well, that's
then
an issue,
everybody
but
else gets to speak.
That's an issue, but, you know, I don't. The Pakistani army is very strong, although, I mean, Kathy Gannon's extraordinary investigation last week, the veteran AP correspondent, showing that most of the money that it even, I mean, we know that so much aid money has gone adrift in Pakistan, but most of the money for the military hasn't even got to the places it should have got to. So they're still running in the frontier with very poor equipment and equipment that should have been paid for, had been paid for by Western money in recent years. But no, there is clearly a huge issue in Pashtunistan. The 1893 Durand Line remains the most insecure border anywhere in the world, drawn rather whimsically by Durand in his negotiations with Abdurrahman, as described in my book. But it and it was a really, really, what was always unstable even then. And the British believed then that Waziristan would be somehow stabilised, and they could bring that into the British Empire, and they couldn't even then. The Northwest frontier has remained outside Pakistani central government control always since, and the sort of habits that Christina describes in terms of handing over young girls to deal with disputes are still highly popular in those areas. So it's a pretty lawless kind of place. But whether it'll actually secede from Pakistan, whether it'll become a wider Pashtunistan, given the will of the Afghan armed forces, I doubt a lot.
Okay. I would love to chat to you afterwards about Quetta.
And we will have a little time to people to mingle.
But I mean, what I would just say very quickly is Pakistan, I think, is much more resilient than people think. And each time things have happened that I've thought, this is really bad and Pakistan can't survive this. I mean, after Benazir's assassination, I went back in January of last year, and I just thought I was very pessimistic about the future of Pakistan. And yet, within a few months, elections were held really quite smoothly, reasonably fairly, and everything went on. And so it does seem to have a tremendous ability to withstand these terrible things that happen from time to time.
Hi, my name is Sanaz Meshkinpour, and I'm with the Columbia Journalism School. And you mentioned a number of examples of individuals fleeing as well as entire villages fleeing. Can you elaborate on kind of the status of refugees, either internally displaced or refugees fleeing to other countries from Afghanistan right now, and kind of the conversation within Afghanistan about it?
Well, one thing I think people don't appreciate is there's still, I think I'm right in saying, still 1.5 million refugees, Afghan refugees in Pakistan, who haven't gone back. And this is one of the problems, that those camps are an easy recruiting ground, and that's where a lot of the Taliban are coming from. Inside Afghanistan, I don't really know. I mean, there's refugees just outside of Kabul who have come back from places. There are refugees just outside of Lashkargah in the capital of Helmand who have fled from fighting in different places, but I'm afraid I don't know the numbers.
It's a huge churn of people. One of the issues is it's made other more sophisticated aid programs harder to do. because you just if you've got people moving just into camps, then it's quite hard to do any other kind of effective nation building. But I don't have a figure actually. There's a last question.
Yes, sir.
Before we all turn into pumpkins.
Miles Hankin, I'm with Asian Programs Foundation, and I wanted to ask both of you. Referred in different ways to Islam. Mr. Lohan, you referred to fundamentalism, and Ms. Lam, you, in your story about the orphanage, mentioned that the people who had threatened him were referred to money from the infidels. So I'm curious to know what in the West we should know and understand about the role of Islam in all of this and in Afghanistan.
It's an Islamic country, but which has a very significant, one of the sadnesses of recent years is that there's a very sort of syncretic, Sufi, you know, music-loving, poetic Islam, both in the Northwest Frontier and in Afghanistan, which is really being sidelined by the extreme demands. And this happened during the Mujahideen years in the 1980s, as well as obviously under the Taliban. I'm just very struck by how far back the ability to use Islam as a cry for nationalist purposes, as a sort of war cry, goes back in Afghanistan. A book written by a good friend of mine called Charles Allen, called God's Terrorists, draws the origins of South Asian Wahhabism right back to Wahhabi. The desert in Saudi Arabia in the middle of the 18th century, a pretty compelling case for saying that the exact strands that draw all that inspire Osama bin Laden in some of the same places where there were people called Hindustani fanatics who fought against the British in the 19th century, and by the same kind of creed. I mean, you couldn't begin to create any kind of an Afghanistan that wasn't an Islamic country. But there might be ways, if you can provide security and stability, and none of these things can happen without some stability, if you can provide stability, there might be ways of reminding, of using Afghans to remind other Afghans of some of the more complex and diverse sorts of Islam which existed in the country before the rather boring Wahhabi fundamentalists, mullahs, got such a hold. I mean, they're not popular in a lot of places. You know, people don't like the mullah necessarily, but Islam is not a faith with a pope or a bishop or a leadership that can govern these things. It's often very locally managed, and Sharia law and the Wahhabis are pretty strong at the moment. And I have to say, backed, of course, by the richest Wahhabi nation in the world, which is Saudi Arabia. So there's a vast amount of influence from that source, which is going to be quite hard to crack. And you won't do it without stability.
Christina.
I would have said back in the 1980s that tribe and tradition was more important to Afghans than Islam.
We'll read Olivier Roy's book, because he absolutely says that in all of the breakdown that was happening there, Sharia law became the one thing that held people together.
People used to meet. I know when I was travelling with the Mujahideen, they would always make fun of the mullahs. So all their jokes were all mullah Nasruddin.
Yes, yes,
But at the same time, and I personally found this quite horrifying, you would be with them and they would be launching an attack on the Soviets. I was on a particular attack which was a rather misguided attack by a small group of Afghan Mujahideen against the big Russian airbase at Kandahar, which failed. And we all had to run. And we were running and running. And then suddenly they all stopped to pray. And I was like, we've got to get out of here. But they had to pray. So that kind of made me realize how important it was to them. And there's no doubt that American advisors during the 1980s really encouraged them to use Islam as a rallying cry. And it was they that talked about jihad and how this was a jihad. And I, as David said, I mean, rather brings this round full circle, as he said at the beginning, you know, some of those groups were actually very anti-American, were taking all this American aid. And as a very young, naive journalist, I was quite astonished by this, that these people like Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who was getting the majority of American aid, would raise all these anti-American slogans. So we kind of got what we asked for, in a way.
Well, thank you both. I have a job, two jobs, actually, for you folks. One is that over the coming days and weeks, as the U.S. debate over Afghan policy unfolds, think and argue about the things we've heard tonight. The other is much simpler and immediate, which is to buy these nice people buy their books and get them to sign them. So with that, thank you, Christina Lamb. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all of you.